Well, good evening and thank you very much for coming. My name is David Webb. I'm the director of the Financial Markets Group here at the LSE, where I also direct, along with Tim Besley, the UBS LSE Pensions Research Program. My job's a very simple one this evening, other than to say welcome to you. It's to say how grateful we are to Watson and Wyatt for organising this event, with a little help from my administration at the FMG here at the LSE, and to say how delighted we are that the first speaker that we've got through this particular relationship with Watson Wyatt here at the LSE is with one of the very best researchers in the world of pensions, a tremendously influential economist, Zvi Bodie. Now, the general introductions, the master of ceremonies, and entertainer for the evening is Mike Orsak. So I'll hand you over to Mike and sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, David, and welcome, everyone. Research and relationships with universities are very important to Watson Wyatt. In the past 3 years, in fact, we've had academics from 28 different institutions in Europe into our offices to give seminars, and it's an important part of building good thinking and ideas to bring to our clients. Tonight, I'm pleased to welcome Zvi Bodie. Zvi's been working on the area of pensions for more than 30 years. He's an author of many books, articles, is well known in the area to all, and he currently is professor of finance at Boston University and chief knowledge officer of Integrated Finance Limited. But he has a lot of other connections as well. He's connected with the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, one of the leading pension research groups in the United States, and he has been for some time. And back in the late 70s and early 80s, he led a very important effort on empirical pension finance at the National Bureau of Economic Research. One of his latest ventures, though, I'm involved in with him, the Journal of Pension Economics and Finance, which Zvi's on the editorial board, and we started this 3 years ago. I encourage you all to subscribe. It's the only academic journal on pension economics and finance issues. Now, Zvi's lecture tonight, Life Cycle of Finance and Defined Contribution Pensions, reviews a lot of his latest thinking on the topic of defined contribution pensions. And a lot of it's reflected in a co-authored book he's put out called Worry-Free Investing, which I encourage you all to take a look at. So, Zvi?
Thanks, Michael, David, and thanks to all of you for coming. I still find it hard to believe that people are willing to spend their free time listening to me talk about these topics. As Michael pointed out, I've been plowing this field for quite a few years, and it's really only recently that a broader audience has started to take an interest in these issues. Now, since I was asked to speak at the London School of Economics, which to an economics PhD like me is in many ways one of the big brand names in academic economics, I decided to take as my topic what economic theory has to say about defined contribution pensions. Now, you know, when I talk in front of audiences generally in the United States, they are in general quite incredulous when I tell them that economic theory has any practical value whatsoever. However, let me assure you that there are those of us who believe that the key to a systematic approach to understanding the most important issues of our times really can be found in economic theory. The earliest economic theories were about life cycle consumption, as those of you who may have studied economics formally are pretty well aware. And yet, you would not know this from reading the popular literature on investing for retirement, for example. And it has always amazed me, still does amaze me, that the connection has not been made between the economic theory of rational life cycle saving and investment behavior and what people really ought to do with their life cycle savings and investments. And so really, the essence of my talk today is to try and convince you that what economists have written about that subject, and of course I will include myself in that list as one in a long list of much more eminent economists than myself, really is quite relevant to the issues that we're facing today. And that, in fact, the future is ours, okay? That is to say, all the trends that I see in the pension world are leading in the direction of following what economic theory has to say about this. Now, of course, that's roughly what I'm going to be talking about. I should say they have very advanced equipment here at the London School of Economics. However, I insisted on using the most primitive form of slide presentation. Right, David? It was all my insistence. Audio-visual effects. Right. Because I want to get back to the old way of doing economics. Okay, there are four major points in my presentation. The first is very briefly to give you an overview of the economic theory of the life cycle, because I think that is where we're going to find our solutions. Then I want to talk about problems that are currently being faced with defined contribution pension plans, likely future trends, and finally, what I think is the future, namely the use of modern financial engineering techniques to provide new types of saving and investment vehicles for defined contribution plans and other life cycle goals. So that's the structure. How much time do I have, by the way? Do we have 45 minutes? Does that include questions? 45 minutes including questions? Before questions, then there'll be questions. Okay, good.
By the way, I should say, first of all, can you in the back hear me if I don't use the microphone? Okay. I will use the microphone, but just in case I speak without, you can still hear me. So, first of all, what does economics say about life cycle consumption? It's really life cycle consumption. Well, the basic theory, the simplest theory, says every individual starts their adult life, and that's usually where we start in economics. We don't bother with children. With an endowment of future labor income, earning power. And we call the present value of that stream of future earnings human capital. And in many cases, we can borrow against that, for example, to improve our earning capacity through getting a graduate degree and so forth, or we can consume more in early years of life in order more than we earn with the knowledge that we can pay it back in the future. But the basic point is the present value of our lifetime earnings is our wealth. Our lifetime is our wealth. And that has to finance our lifetime consumption. In the language of economics, there's a lifetime budget constraint. The present value of all of our consumption spending over our lifetime, and I'm leaving out bequests here, intergenerational transfers, just for simplicity. The theory certainly can accommodate that. But the basic idea is we have to live within a budget over our lifetime. The total amount we spend in present value terms cannot exceed the total amount we earn. Okay. But within this constraint, that's the budget constraint, and as you all know, if you've studied any economics, there's an optimization that takes place. Rational individuals have certain preferences, and they allocate their budget in such a way as to maximize lifetime utility. Okay, utility maximization. Now, with this framework and these simple assumptions, one can actually derive lifetime consumption paths, saving paths. Okay? And in the simplest models, all uncertainty is ignored. So if you look at the early models of the life cycle as developed by Franco Modigliani and Milton Friedman, work which was done in the late 1940s, early 1950s, their models have no uncertainty in it. Franco Modigliani talks about human capital or present value of lifetime earnings. Milton Friedman talks about permanent income. All these things are studied in our basic micro and macroeconomics courses. I'm sure here at LSE, as elsewhere. If you take those models seriously and were, for example, to build a web-based retirement saving model, okay, at one of these websites like, what was the latest one I saw? Well, Financial Engines is Bill Sharpe's. That's one of the more sophisticated ones, and I will have some critical things to say even about that one later on when I get going. But for now, while I'm still being agreeable, one of the cutest models I've seen is at a website called IHateFinancialPlanning.com. It's really a lot to type in, but no one else has taken that, you know, website name. And it is actually owned by ING Insurance Company. And all these models have as their purpose to help individuals who obviously hate financial planning to guide them through the process of deciding how much they need to save for their retirement. And in essence, they really are just implementations of this model. Of course, it's presented as a black box. But the basic idea is there's some interest rate, you project your earnings, and you smooth your consumption over your lifetime, so you're saving a constant fraction of your income. And the model tells you what that constant fraction has to be to satisfy your budget constraint, okay, so that it all works. If it doesn't work, a red light flashes on your screen, and it says something like, does not compute, try again. Now, of course, in most cases, the way they solve the problem is they say, try a higher rate of interest. Okay, if your savings are not enough, you just need to earn more. And of course, the way you do that is by investing more in stocks. That's the standard answer that these programs come up with. And we'll talk, that's one of the big problems with defined contribution pension plans, so we'll get to that in a little while. But looked at from the point of view of an economic model, all it's saying is this. This is my own little version of IHateFinancialPlanning.com. Okay, it's a simple retirement savings planner,
There's a starting age, let's say it's 25 in my example, and of course you can change that. This is just an Excel spreadsheet, right? Retirement age 65, ending age 85. I'm going to let my earnings at age 25 be $100,000. That's to make everybody feel bad. And a risk-free real rate of interest of 3%, which, as you can see, can be changed with that little wonderful little Excel device. I forget what they call it, but you know, you just press on that and you change the interest rate. Growth rate of real earnings, I've used 2% here, and a time preference rate. Now, the time preference rate is far more sophisticated. That's a variable that comes out of any economic model, but you'll never see it in any of the online financial planners because people don't have no clue what that is. But basically, we can think of it as something that says, do we want more consumption early in life or later in life? Okay, do we want to front load our consumption or back load our consumption? And this model automatically will solve for feasible consumption and saving paths. So you see, the blue line is earnings. So it starts out at 100,000 at age 25. Zero is age 25. And as you can see, it's growing, in this case, at 2% per year. And then it falls off to zero at age 65. Does everybody see that? So that's your earnings trajectory. The present value of that is your human capital. And then the question is, what does your consumption stream look like? Well, given a time preference rate of 2%, the way it looks is, as you see in that diagram, the red line. Now, obviously, the consumption doesn't stop at retirement. It stops at your expiration date. Okay, which in this case is age 85. So what's happening here is that the blue stream of earnings, which lasts for 40 years, is financing the red stream of consumption, which lasts for 60 years. That's what this is all about. And given my preference rate here, that red stream is actually optimal for this particular consumption. It's affordable and it's optimal. And it implies, as you can see in the diagram below, a certain pattern of human capital, financial wealth, and total wealth. Now, the financial wealth here is the accumulated retirement savings. So it's the part of earnings which is not being consumed, that's the savings. That's growing at 3% per year, and it's accumulating, and your human capital, as years go by, is being depleted, right, as you earn whatever it is you're earning. So the picture looks like this.
This blue curve is your human capital, which in this example starts out at about $3.5 million. Raise your hand if you can hear me in the back. Great. That the blue curve goes to zero by the time you reach age 65. This green line is your accumulated savings, and it's growing. It reaches its maximum at age 65, and then you draw down those savings to provide your consumption.
So this is what I think is a fairly simple scheme that makes clear what is going on in most of the retirement planners that you see being offered at defined contribution plan websites. These are ubiquitous today in the United States. Okay, defined contribution plans in the United States are very widespread. And virtually every financial service company has at its website a retirement savings planner that essentially helps you through this, okay, in some user-friendly fashion. Now, as I already said, this type of model completely sidesteps the issue of how to invest your savings, namely how much risk to take with your retirement savings. It does address the issue of how much to save, but clearly how much to save depends on what you assume about the rate of interest, which in turn depends on how you're investing your money. So there's a simultaneity that goes on here. And there are lots of models that try to deal in some effective way with investment risk to help people make the right investment choices. Now, my first point about the defined contribution plans is this. Even without uncertainty, which is a huge complication in the model, how many people without degrees in economics would be able to understand and solve this simple problem? My guess, a tiny fraction of the population. How do I know this? Folks, I've been teaching for 33 years at a major university in the United States, and really good students, juniors, seniors in college, not to mention MBA students, have trouble with this. A lot of trouble with this. And when you add in investment uncertainty, we start getting into territory which is difficult. Difficult. Not something, in my view, that millions, you know, the masses of people are going to be in a position to solve or work through on their own. Nor will they be able to interpret efficient portfolio frontiers, or if you even know what that is, or Monte Carlo simulation output, okay, which gets superimposed on this. Just way too complicated for most people. So I tend to get very nervous and, shall we say, highly skeptical of any solutions to social problems, widespread social problems like inadequate retirement savings, that rely on millions of people being able to solve this on their own, or for that matter, even with the guidance of a financial planner.
But of course, as you will know, surely, financial planners and mutual fund companies, and in general, the whole investment industry, has taken a tough problem and made it far worse. How have they done that? And I am not saying they've done it deliberately. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I just believe people are opportunistic and they do what's in their own best interest. It is in the best interest of the investment industry for all of you to invest your savings in stocks. And over the last 30, 40 years, the stock market, by and large, has done reasonably well, at least in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And a certain set of beliefs has developed, been promulgated, which are, at their core, fundamentally wrong. But here is what the belief is. The belief is, okay, this is the correct way of thinking about it, but the belief is the following. If you have a long time horizon, stocks aren't risky. Stocks will go up, stocks will go down, but over the long run, they're always going to come back, and they're always going to beat all the alternative assets that are out there. How many of you have ever heard this pitch in one form or another? Okay, well, the rest of you, I guess, don't read, don't go
don't watch television or whatever. But this is, you know, what we call in the United States the conventional wisdom. And it is not just the media that drives home this idea of, it's sometimes called time diversification. And it is very, very firmly believed by the entire financial planning and investment advisory establishment. So firmly believed that when I question it in public forums, I sometimes think, my life is at stake. Okay? I am viewed as a dangerous person for questioning this basic idea. Now, I should point out, it's not just I that is questioning this idea. This idea contradicts basic economic theory. I mean, it's not as if economists have not written about this subject. Paul Samuelson wrote at least 4 major articles on the question of time diversification and showed in at least 4 different ways that it is a fallacious belief. The fundamental truth is, first, there is no necessary connection between the length of one's time horizon and one's tolerance for risk. These are 2 different things. You can be saving for a distant objective, your retirement, and be very risk averse, or you can be saving for something that's coming up very shortly and be very risk tolerant. No connection between the two in economic theory, or for that matter in simple logic. Right? So let's think about it for a second. Why would there be a connection between the two? And yet, every single financial planning program that I have ever tried on the web, and believe me, I've tried many. So this is a challenge. If you think you've found one that contradicts what I'm about to say, please send me an email and I will send you a check in the mail for an unspecified amount. Here's what they all do. You go to the website and it's supposed to guide you through the process of asset allocation, portfolio selection. And they say a major determinant of how much you should invest in equities is your tolerance for risk. So we're going to guide you through the process by asking you to answer the following questions. And there's a risk tolerance questionnaire. Show of hands, how many of you have ever filled out one of these things? Quite a few. Great. Here's what I have discovered. No matter what you answer, there's only one question that will determine what category they put you into. And it is the question, how long is your time horizon? In other words, how many years before you need the money that you're saving? If you answer more than 10 years, no matter what else you say about everything else, they're going to say, put at least 50% in equities. That's my finding. Okay? So the challenge is out there. Go back to your favorite program, okay, and see if I'm not right about this. Now, what in effect they're saying is, if you have a long time horizon, you're risk tolerant. Why? I have tried in these programs. The reason I'm so confident when I say to you that this is true is I have deliberately answered every question, you know, as the most risk-averse person you could believe. You know, they ask you, would you ever ride on a motorcycle? No. Hell no. You know, would you have all these things that they ask you to determine your risk tolerance? And I say to them, I'm not willing to take any risk under any circumstances. My time horizon is more than 10 years. Boom, I'm 50% in equities. Time and time again. So why? Why does this happen? And the answer is because of the belief, which is an article of faith among the people who build these models, that the risk of stocks is negligible in the long run. Now, how can so many reasonably intelligent people be so wrong? One answer, maybe they're not as reasonable or as intelligent as we thought. I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is that there is some compelling logic in the way the history of stock returns is presented, such that people absolutely believe that time diversification works, and that the longer your time horizon, the more you can neglect or ignore the risk of stocks. And the way it works is this. They say, let's use as our measure of risk, and here I'm going to show you a diagram. Now, naturally, I took this from a website that's called Investor Education. In fact, it's called Smart Money University. So this is an institution of higher learning on the web. It licenses its educational material to lots and lots of other websites, because the Smart Money University is run by none other than the Dow Jones Company, which owns the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, highly respected organization, which many people would consider to be authoritative. I mean, if you didn't know better, and most people don't, they'd think this is the, why would they listen to someone like Zvi Bodhi when they can learn directly from the Wall Street Journal? Why not, right? Compelling. Here's what they say. Where to invest your retirement savings shouldn't be that complicated, whatever that means. In other words, we start off with some wishful thinking to get us in the mood. It depends largely on a single factor, time. The more time you have before you plan to retire, the more aggressively you should be invested in equities. If, as for many people, the stock market makes you nervous, check out time versus risk. Okay, this is, you click on this, and it's one of these applets, you know, a Java applet, where you go, wow, how do they do that? You know, it's fascinating, and they've got the historical data, and how could anyone question this? And of course, it's all a pack of fallacious lies. Wait, a fallacious lie, that's a double negative. Misleading information. Check out time versus risk for an interactive demonstration of why this simple axiom holds true in good times and bad. And here's the line that really gets my goat. History shows clearly that equities are your best long-term investment option. So if logic doesn't convince you, history certainly should convince you. Okay, well, unfortunately, we don't have an interactive hookup here, because what I would do is click on that thing, and we'd go to the website, and I'd show you this very convincing Java applet. But you've seen it dozens of times, so I can just tell you what it is, and I'm sure it'll stimulate your memories. What it shows is this. It shows the average compound rate of return and its range of values. And so for a while, and on the horizontal axis is number of years that you hold the portfolio. And it compares stocks and bonds and cash and maybe some other asset classes, but in this case, just those three. And what it shows is if you have a one-year time horizon, then the range of possible rates of return on stocks is much wider than the range of possible outcomes if you invested in bonds or in cash. How many of you have seen that? Okay. And then what you do is there's the slider, and you increase the number of years that you're going to hold the portfolio. And they show you the range of possible average compound rates of return. And lo and behold, you see it getting narrower and narrower for stocks the longer the holding period. Until you get out to like 25, 30 years, and lo and behold, stocks has a higher average rate of return with no greater risk than cash or bonds. Well, in economic theory, we call that a dominating asset. Okay, for finance people out there, this is an arbitrage opportunity, right? Borrow, and why not invest 200% in equities? How about 300% in equities? It's an arbitrage opportunity. As long as you hold them long enough, you're going to earn more, and it's virtually riskless. Now, the fallacy here is that what you are looking at is the volatility or the range of values of an average. Anyone who has taken statistics knows that if you look at the standard deviation or the volatility of an average, it gets smaller the larger the sample size. So this is just a statistical trick. It has no significance. What you really are concerned about as the length of the time horizon grows longer is not the volatility of your average compound return, but the volatility of your ending wealth. How much are you going to have at the end of this holding period? And the longer the time period gets, the wider that dispersion gets if you're investing in stocks. Does everybody see my point here? When I went to high school, there was a book that we read in our economics class called How to Lie with Statistics. This is a perfect example of it. You show a graph that totally misleads people. It's not that it isn't true. What you're seeing is true. It just doesn't imply what you think it does. Now, in point of fact, it's not just the volatility of average compound rate of return that getting smaller that seems to make stocks look safe. You can also use another measure, namely the probability that stocks will do worse than risk-free bonds. How many of you have heard probability of loss or probability of a shortfall as the measure of risk? Okay? Intuitively, isn't that an appealing measure of risk? Yes, it is intuitively appealing. That's why it's so misleading. If it were obviously stupid, it wouldn't mislead anyone. But it has a lot of intuitive appeal. The problem is, it's wrong. It's misleading. Why? Because probability of a shortfall or probability of a loss is not an adequate measure of risk. Risk consists of at least two factors: the probability of a bad thing happening and the severity of the bad thing happening. In fact, most of the risks that we buy insurance against as individuals have exceedingly small probabilities of occurrence. Nonetheless, we consider them quite risky, and we even pay good money to insure against them because of the severity of the, if they occur, it will have dire consequences. Now, I'm going to show you a diagram that I've tried to develop in countering the tempting, but wrong, intuition. This is a diagram that first appeared in a paper that I published about 9 or 10 years ago on the risk of stocks in the long run. And here's the point. This is the time horizon, and this is the probability of a shortfall measured on this axis, the blue line or the green line. Let's look at the green line, okay? Forget the blue one for a second. Suppose we agree that stocks offer a positive risk premium over bonds, a risk-free alternative. And let's say it's 6% premium. Then, the longer our time horizon is, the smaller will be the probability that you'll have a shortfall with stocks. In other words, that stocks will underperform bonds. That's easy to show. And it's purely a result of the fact that stocks offer a higher expected rate of return. So further out you go, the less probability is going to be in the tail of the distribution. So the probability of a loss goes down. And you can see here that if the period, the holding period is 1 year, according to this diagram, the probability of a shortfall 1 year would be 40%, 0.4. But for a 30-year time horizon, it would fall to approximately 5%. Now, in many of these financial planning engines, like financial engines, 5% is considered to be an acceptable probability of loss. So that basically they say, oh, well, there's only a 5% probability of a shortfall, we can ignore that. In fact, sometimes they just truncate. They don't show you the rest of the tail of the distribution. Okay, and this blue line is if there's a smaller risk premium, but ignore it for a second. Is there a measure of risk that takes an objective measure of risk, doesn't depend on any subjective utility function or anything, that takes account not just of the probability of a shortfall, but also the severity of a shortfall? And the answer is, of course there is. It's the market cost to insure against the risk, right? Insurance companies have to charge a price objectively in order for them to survive that covers the probability of occurrence and the severity of the payout, how big the payout will be. Now, as it turns out, we have a wonderful mathematical model and lots of empirical evidence on this type of insurance, because this is called put option. Insurance against shortfall risk is a put option. So in this case, what we're talking about is a put option on an equity portfolio. And I wanted to you what the Black-Scholes model implies about the cost of insuring against a shortfall for an all-equity portfolio as a fraction of the total investment. So let's say you're investing $1 million. You want to buy insurance against earning less than you would have earned had you invested risk-free interest rate. You buy a one-year put. At current market rates, that would cost you roughly 8% of the value of your investment, around $80,000. Now, suppose you say, wait a second, I don't need to insure the portfolio for 1 year, because I'm going to hold this thing 25 years. Right? All I want is a guarantee against a shortfall 25 years from now. Everybody understand?
verify by talking to investment bankers, or use the Black-Scholes model, that the cost of that put option looks like this as a function of the time to maturity. It increases in cost with the square root of P. So for a one-year horizon, the put would cost you $80,000 on my million-dollar portfolio. But if you said, you know what, I don't need 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, just give me a guarantee that 25 years from now, you'll make up any shortfall relative to what I would have had had I invested in 25-year yields. Well, it turns out that would cost you 40% of the value of your portfolio, $400,000. Everyone get the significance of this? In other words, economic theory is telling me not that risk gets lower the further out of time you go, but if you're measuring risk as the cost of a guarantee against the shortfall, it actually grows with the length of the time horizon. Now think of the practical significance of this. It's huge. And I'm not going to get into all of it, but one obvious application of this is, what if the government is going to provide shortfall insurance for private pension plans? Okay? Now, one of the arguments in favor of this is, well, you know, these pension funds are very long time horizons. How much could those guarantees cost? Well, the answer is huge, huge amounts. Okay? It's extremely costly. In fact, the longer the time horizon, the more costly it can be. So it completely reverses the conventional thinking about time and risk. And as for that, I don't know if you're the only actuary sitting here. Are there any actuaries in the audience?
Okay. Yeah.
You know, this contradicts actuarial thinking, because actuaries have been strong, traditionally have been strong proponents of the idea that there is this time diversification effect. And that was fine before we had option theory where we could prove the opposite. Now we can prove the opposite in theory. You can actually buy these put options. And we see that the cost increases with time. All right, now I'm reaching the end of the allotted time. So what I want to do, I focused on this issue, I think, should be clear, because I think this is the crux of investor miseducation. This is not something that only the untutored masters, the untutored masses get wrong. This is something that the professionals get wrong. And they're the ones who are presumably offering the investment education which is supposed to be guiding the decisions of millions of participants in defined contribution pension plans. So I think this is a big problem. How do we deal with it? Well, I think it's hopeless to try and deal with it through education. Because if the educators themselves, most of them, have it wrong, the more education we're going to do, the more misinformed the public is going to become. But that's in the under the assumption that you could actually do it, that you could educate people. I don't believe you could. Because this is exceedingly complicated. You know, solving a lifetime optimization problem where you have risk, portfolio risk, is not a trivial problem. In fact, it is an extremely complex problem. I spent 2.5 hours this afternoon discussing it with a person, a professional, former colleague of mine from BU, who's now working, heading a team at Credit Suisse First Boston. That's dealing with this issue, and he can confirm for you this is not a trivial problem to solve. It's the equivalent in finance of, you know, performing, say, complicated surgery in medicine. Okay?
Imagine if we, you know, decided to solve the problems of medical cost inflation by saying we should educate everybody, you know, in simple surgical procedures so that we can give them, you know, we can give them a scalpel and a pamphlet and they can remove their own appendix. I mean, it's fairly uncomplicated procedure, right? I don't think, now, it might be cost effective in some sense. But I don't think that would be wise public policy. And in many respects, solving lifetime optimization problems, you know, saving for retirement and investing the money, is every bit, in fact, I think it's probably a lot more complicated than removing an appendix. Although I can't say for sure, never having done the appendix thing. However, how should we deal with this then if education is not the answer? Well, again, I return to the example of medicine. I'll give you a couple of other analogies because I ask myself the question. You know, we live in a fairly sophisticated society where we consume all sorts of highly complicated things, make use of complicated things, whether it's medicine or hi-fi stereos or computers. And we don't have to become experts in these things in order to use them or to make intelligent purchase decisions. Right? Now, let's take the example of medicine. If I am ill and I go in for a diagnosis, I don't know much. I mean, I try to keep abreast of the latest medical developments, but of course, there are lots of problems in doing that, and I don't view myself as an expert. So if I have to make a decision, you know, the doctor says to me, look, there are two ways to treat what you have. One of them is riskier than the other, but, you know, it could have more dire consequences, but whatever, there's a trade-off. I don't know about you, but my response is invariably, doctor, if you were me, what would you do? Right? Now, my doctor is the type of guy who would say, can't make that decision for you. Okay, it's up to you. It depends on your risk aversion or your risk tolerance, whatever. Then I demand some simple explanation that I can understand. And that's hard to do. But certainly, if he started putting up anatomical diagrams, you know, or started to explain the science of medicine to me, that would not help me very much. Okay, I need an explanation that is intuitive, clear, that I can relate to. Now, I think there's an analogy here with defined contribution pension plans. When you ask people how they want to allocate their investment savings, how many of you have had to make that decision at work or some, okay? What information are you usually provided? Well, does it help you? I don't think so. In fact, for the most part, it's the kind of stuff that I was showing here is misleading. So I'm not sure how you do that, but what I am sure about is that the current set of investment products that we are offering people through defined contribution plans are a temporary stopgap because they are not finished products. You cannot today, at least in the United States, in my plan that I belong to, which is a defined contribution plan, I cannot say, okay, I want to choose the alternative that guarantees me a 60% replacement rate of my final salary. No such alternative exists. It's not that it couldn't exist. It could exist. It's just not being offered. In fact, there isn't even an alternative that says you will earn a risk-free rate of return of 2% over inflation. I don't have that alternative in my pension plan. So it's not even, you know, a simple risk-free account. Now, outside of my DC plan, there are such things like Series I savings bonds in the United States. I know you've got postal savings accounts here where you are guaranteed a fixed real rate of interest, and in fact it's tax-free, although the amount that you can save is limited. Well, that's something that people can get their heads around. That's called risk-free investing. You're guaranteed to beat inflation by a certain percentage rate. People can understand that. You don't have to present an efficient frontier. You don't have to present a histogram with probabilities of various rates of return. My view is that the next generation of retirement products that defined contribution plans will be offering, that financial institutions will be offering, will be substitutes for defined benefit plans, which are dying out in this country and in the United States. People, customers, are going to vote with their money. The challenge for financial firms is to produce these products inexpensively and in a form that makes it clear to the end user what the choices are. And I think that is doable. I have here an example of something that my firm that I'm a partner in is trying to develop now. We hope to roll out in the next year or so for 401k plans in the United States. And it's something called an escalating annuity. And the idea is this. There's a base level of retirement income. You buy it as a deferred annuity. There's a guaranteed minimum level. And then you can save an extra amount, which gets invested in equity options. Okay? Now, exactly how to design those is something that we are working with focus groups to develop, because we do believe this isn't an educational process, but it is a process of communication with the end user to try and see what kinds of risks, when properly understood, they are willing to take with their retirement money. So the basic idea, just to give you an example of an escalating annuity, I have, it's the last page in the handout. Who's accumulated $1 million in her retirement account. There's a 401k retirement account. And for the moment, I'm assuming we have this product available. The woman is expecting $15,000 per year in Social Security benefits. Now, one option would be to invest the entire $1 million in a guaranteed inflation-protected annuity. But if she's willing to take some risk, what she could do is take 90% of her money and buy a real annuity. And at current interest rates, that would get her, well, actually now it would be a little bit less than that, it would get her an inflation-proof annuity of roughly $55,000 per year. Now I would say it'd be more like $50,000 a year. But let's go with the $55,000. Now that's a lifetime annuity, so it'll last for as long as she lives. Add that to the $15,000, and she has guaranteed income of $70,000 per year, adjusted for inflation. Now, the other $100,000 of her million, 10% of that million, is invested in equities to produce real income growth. Now, the way I envision it, she would buy a series of call options on a market index, which will either be in or out of the money at the end of each of the next 10 years. If the equity market goes up, that gets converted into a step up in her lifetime real annuity, as in an escalator. If equities don't go up, her income remains the same. What cannot happen is her real income in retirement goes down. Do you all see the idea? Now, the choice here for this individual would be, well, how much do I want to put into the guaranteed annuity versus how much do I want to put into the equity component, which can produce growth? To my mind, getting to understand, teaching people to understand the implications of that trade-off will be difficult, but doable and meaningful, because it's framed in a way that people normally think about taking chances. You know, people buy lottery tickets. Okay, they typically do not buy lottery tickets, with some exceptions, with money that they need to buy the necessities. They tend to treat risk-taking as a kind of luxury. And I think that's probably right for most people. Because when you're talking about retirement income, you're talking about income that is replacing the ability to earn money. Once you're retired, for most of us, we can't go back and earn more, or it would be extremely tiresome to do that. So every dollar counts, and in my view, risk is a luxury in that sense. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Michael has been very patiently showing me the number of minutes remaining, and there are none at this point. Now, do you want to take questions?
Thank you very much, Steve. Zvi's had a long-running debate with Professor Jeremy Siegel of the Wharton School on time diversification. And the latest round is on issues of mean reversion, and it's an ongoing debate. It's a very eloquent discussion about these issues. Long run. So not all economists agree on this topic, but...
Oh, no, wait, you're wrong. You're wrong. Let me just ask this, Michael, if I might.
Yep.
Jeremy Siegel and I...
Went to school together.
We went to school together. We're both students of Paul Sanders. So I always have known that Jeremy at heart couldn't disagree with what I'm saying. No matter how much money he gets from the mutual fund industry. So we had a debate at the National Convention of the Financial Planners Association in Toronto.
Very
April 23rd.
Okay.
And I actually have the CD recording of the debate. It was an hour and a half debate. And we agreed on every single issue.
Okay.
Everything that I said here today, Jeremy agreed.
Okay. Well, I think that it's useful to stimulate a lot of debate, and therefore invite, before we take questions, I'm inviting Roger Irwin, who's Global Head of Investment Consulting for Watson Wyatt, to say some words about this, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Zvi. My job is in about 10 minutes to give a little bit more perspective, and that's hard because there's a lot of meat to this subject. It's very hard because he's a tough act to follow, and it's even more hard because he only covered half his slides. And I kind of wanted to talk about the other slides, but there we go. The first view that I can totally agree with here in terms of the way this has come through this evening is that DC, pretty much in all countries, is in a first generation of development in terms of sophistication. And I think that's really because we still have very poor financial understanding, we have very limited innovation. So very much echoing Zvi's words on that. The question is, how can that be? I'm puzzled, but I do think there's something here about the sort of agency issues in our industry, and I do think the investment industry is very passionate about equities for reasons that aren't always in their clients' interests. And so I think we have to be pretty careful about the state of the DC industry at the moment. So it's great to have some research perspective on it from that point of view. And it very much helps when I think a number of the messages are dead right. In that category, stocks get riskier over time, absolutely. In his piece, DC needs a view about consumption more than about wealth maximization. It's about consumption. We don't always think in those terms. And it's human capital alongside wealth that counts. I've already said principal agent risk in this area is a real problem, basically because of the asymmetry of understanding between buyer and seller, which is really, really big in many situations and presents moral hazard. And costs is a great example of that, and DC features are oversold. My favorite example is the US DC market, which spends massive amounts on fund manager branding, costs of over $1 billion a year, benefits to plan participants probably negative because asset management gathering is destructive of value to the investors. It may be adding value to shareholders. So great clarity with a number of those points that I took out of Zvi's session. The qualification is really about some of the practical application here, which Zvi's already come quietly on. And this is where I like the word satisficing. It's about obtaining an outcome that is good enough to contrast with optimizing, which is what we have in our theory, which seeks the best but always requires more complicated processes. So in investment, we think about optimization first, but the average rational DC investor doesn't seek the optimized result. They actually seek a result which is good enough, which is rather different. So some satisficing issues, if you will. So in today's restricted labor markets, delaying retirement isn't pretty. It's a bit better in the US, but it's not easy over here. Some of the life cycle theory actually does require the practice of varying the retirement age. Svi likes to have a view that you can target an unacceptable downside risk, but that's not always available. It's not always easy to articulate. Often people will have to run risk below that threshold, so that's not easy to deal with. Nor are index-linked annuities in terms of availability or pricing. And that's not the appropriate shape for everyone's consumption either. So those are little practical things where it all gets a little bit more shaky. And I think one of the fascinating things for us in the UK is that the range of choices isn't too great in DC. It's sort of in the 6 to 8 area, whereas in the US we all know that there's an overwhelming bunch of choices. And one of the major themes that Svi had put forward is that when you had choices, you need them to be easily understood, and therefore you need a limited number of those. But again, when you're dealing with the practical point here, which is, are any of these choices easily understood? I think you can turn it round from the employer's point of view and think that if they give much wider choice, that reduces liability risk because one way or another, one of those choices will have done well. So it all becomes a bit more difficult. And one other take on the understanding, and it is about why does the 30-year-old invest in substantially in equities in DC, and why does the 50-year-old invest less in equities, because that could be a fallacy. But I do think that people get it right for the wrong reasons, and in this area, it's definitely not about time diversification, but it is about the idea of human capital. I like to see it slightly differently from the way that Zvi puts it here. Human capital being kind of bond, which you can complement alongside equities. And also, think about it as a deal between yourself and your future. So if you invest in equities and they pay off, that deal works pretty well. You can consume away. But if the equities don't pay off because you hit the downside, then you can do the deal by which higher contributions kick in, essentially lower consumption. And that deal, if you're a 30-year-old, can be pulled off many more times than the deal that applies to the 50-year-old. And so that's a take on why we actually have the right answer for the wrong reasons. But the trouble is that isn't at all clear. I don't think people really conceptually get that, and it's very challenging because it's about what if contingents on other what ifs. And when you actually think about it that way, when we go back to the financial planning tools, which are terrifically whizzy, they just can't deal with that degree of complexity. And so I don't think it's any accident, therefore, that people like Financial Engines have achieved far less penetration than we would have expected. So from that point of view, I think we have much more to see in that area. So where next? I think it is about innovation, and we touched on that at the end. There are better instruments. I believe that innovation has been very slow in DC. There's a dearth of decent product. Certainly, the hockey stick payoff is a sensible proposition. So call options are part of that. Call options maturing at different dates, laddering arrangements. structured equity participation. You can get those at about a 10-year range now. Surely long-dated index calls, that sort of range should be around the corner. The key thing is these are systematic ways to deal with risk, and systematic tends to trump the behavioral biases. It tends to keep the behavioral biases in check, and behavioral finance, behavioral biases are huge in this area. And then when it comes to post-retirement, we're in this environment where annuities really come in a very sort of impoverished shape, I think. They should come in much richer shapes and sizes. It is about reinventing the annuity. Some markets have too much in annuities, the UK. Other markets have too little in annuities, the US. There's some middle ground because drawdown does represent it. Common theme through that, though, is very much that you need information, education, advice, sometimes delegation. And I believe that the majority of the action at the moment is rather a sales type activity, not an independent activity. And I think that's part of our difficulty here. We need more freedom from bias in the work in DC. So just to summarize with a couple of thoughts here, worry-free investing, which hasn't been referred to, and we're not even waving around copies. Unique non-sales guide to personal investing. If you look at all the other books in the area, they're pro-equities. Importance of DC, absolutely mission critical for planet Earth. There is a hugely important issue about how efficiently we get past this dysfunctional arrangement at the moment. The current state of DC, dysfunctional, not very efficient, over-expensive, underperforming. A number of steps by which we can get to good enough. I think that's the next step. And I do think we're on the verge of some breakthroughs. I certainly appreciate the clarity with which Savi has shared his research. Thank you.
We now have time for some questions for both Savi and Roger. Because there's no microphone, you may need to speak up a bit. Questions? Yes?
Yes, I think, first of all, you're pointing to the crux of the issue. But mind you, this is not unique to retirement planning. I mean, I face the same type of moral hazard issues as a consumer of automobile repair services, for example. How do I know that the mechanic that I bring my car into, since I don't know anything about automobile repair, how do I know that he's not replacing things that don't need replacing and so forth? So it's not unique to retirement. But I think the way we deal with this problem generally is the products that we consume are finished products. That is to say, we have a pretty good idea of how they're supposed to work. So if I get my car back from the mechanic, it's true he might charge me three times as much as I truly needed to pay. But if he hasn't repaired what was wrong with the car, I'll know it. At least that much. And I'd like us to get to that point with investment products. I don't think we're there. I don't think we're even close. And, how could we be? Because what we're offering today is a set of inputs rather than outputs to people. In other words, we're not specifying the product in terms of here's your guaranteed level, that's something we can understand, and the rest is, going to move with the market. What we're doing is we're specifying choices in terms of, do you want 60% equities, 40% bonds, or some other mix of inputs, where people haven't got a clue what that mix means. The menu is flawed. The product menu is flawed. And in that situation, you're truly at the mercy, you being the consumer, are truly at the mercy of the vendor. It basically saying, trust me, without understanding exactly what you're getting or even approximately what you're getting. That's why I am so much in favor of innovations that push us more in the direction of user-friendly products. So people really, I'll just give you one example. I remember the early days of personal computers where, I'm not a computer engineer, and I'd have a lot of trouble putting together a machine that worked with compatible parts. And in the early days, that's what you did. You went to a vendor and you specified, what components you wanted. And of course, you didn't. What you did was you asked the salesperson to choose the components for you. We don't do it that way anymore. Now it's plug and play. In fact, I recently bought a personal computer at the Dell website. And you look at how that's designed, and I said to myself, my God, this is the way a defined contribution plan should be. Because, first of all, they ask you, what do you want to use this thing for? Okay, they don't present components and their performance characteristics. They say, you want to use this for word processing, playing games, et cetera. And then they lead you through a process whereby you can choose a machine. You don't buy more than you need, and you don't buy less than you need. And that, I think, is the direction we need to go.
Next
No, it's the fact that what you're looking at is an average compound rate of return per period. In other words, the averaging is occurring because you're dividing by the number of periods. In other words, suppose I invest a dollar now and I get $72, okay, 10 years from now. The relevant number is $72. That's how much wealth I'll have. But I can compute the average rate of return that I've earned, right? Which it would be, 7% per year. So the average compound rate of return over that over that 72-year period, I'm sorry, over that, 10-year period, is 7%. How did I get that? The answer is, I averaged over the years. Now, suppose I do simulations of 10-year returns on an equity portfolio. I'm going to have a distribution of how much wealth I would have at the end of 10 years. I could express that as, say, the mean is $72 for every dollar I invest. The standard deviation is going to be a large number. You follow what I'm saying? That's a standard deviation of terminal wealth. Or I can represent it in terms of the standard deviation of my average compound rate of return over the 10 years. So the mean would be 7% per year. The standard deviation will be actually very small. Because over a 10-year period, a small difference in average compound return gets magnified quite a lot. Now, what's happening in these studies that show lower volatility is they're doing the opposite. They're taking this wide distribution of average wealth at the end of periods, and they're making it smaller by showing you the standard deviation of the average compound rate of return. So that's the point. The point is the number of years over which you are computing average compound rate of return. The longer the number, the longer the period will be, the longer the period you take, the smaller will be the standard deviation of the average compound rate of return over that number of years. I hope I'm making myself clear.